Shrink Wrap Radio number 674, Tools for Living Your Unstoppable Life with Catherine DeMonte.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Catherine DeMonte, a licensed marriage, family, child therapist for over 25 years and author of the 2019 book, Beep, Beep, Get Out of My Way, 7 Tools for Living Your Unstoppable Life. For more information about Catherine DeMonte, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. the world's largest e-counseling platform. Now, here's the interview. Catherine DeMonte, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be with you, Dr. Dave.
Well, thank you. You have such a delightful presence already. I can feel it.
Thank
and,
you.
So I think it's we're going nice to have a good session here.
And thank you.
Course, when you reached out to me, you told me a story that I loved. About how you discovered Shrink Wrap Radio, and I would love to have you share that here.
Oh, it's such a nice story. Thank you for asking me to share it. I have a twin that still lives in the city where we grew up, but I moved away. And every year on our birthday, she and her husband host a joint birthday party for the two of us with our mutual friends about 4 hours away. And there are usually about 18 or 20 people there at a long communal table in their house. And it's really lovely with really amazing, interesting people. And I was sitting at that table at my birthday party and turned to some people sitting near me that I adore. Selena and Robert are their names. And because they're such wise, awesome people, I asked them if they knew of any podcasts or what they like listening to, because I hadn't been listening to any in a while, and I like being stimulated by the and learning about new ones. And at this exact same time, they said, "Yes, Shrink Wrap. It's our favorite. We love it."
Yeah, and you said so, they spoke simultaneously.
They said at the exact same time.
Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, which made them turn to each other and start laughing. And then the three of us started laughing like that. You know, it was so synchronistic for them to come up with the exact same one, the exact same moment, and with such enthusiasm.
Yeah.
So when I reached out to you and met you, I thought, I can see exactly why they adore him.
Well,
he's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I'm a lover of synchronicity. That's got to be said. And so that was a great way to approach me.
And
then I saw that synchronicity also plays a role in your book that you've written. We're going to be discussing your work, and we're going to be discussing this great new book. It's just come out, hasn't it? It's pretty recent.
Yes, it came out in June.
It's the title is Beep Beep. I'm thinking of the Roadrunner here. Beep Beep. Get Out of My Way. 7 Tools for Living an Unstoppable Life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about your book. But you've been a therapist for some time. And I thought, let's back up a little bit. And, the introduction to your book was very rich. And I'm always looking for, well, what's this person's story? You know, and fortunately, you went right there in the introduction and gave us a really panoramic view of, you know, how we got up to this moment. And so how did you come to find the path of being a therapist? That actually comes later in the story. Let's go back to the stuff that you cover in the intro, your family of origin, your hopes, your fears, your challenges, all of that.
To answer the first question about how I got into it, as a teenager, I really admired several adults who all happened to be psychologists or psychiatrists, a couple of ministers, everybody I really looked up to were empathic. They were good listeners. They were healers.
Wow.
And I aspired to be like them. I liked them very much.
Where did you grow up that you had that exposure?
In Central California in Fresno.
Okay. California. That
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah. And took a psychology class probably because of those people. And I knew in high school I wanted to be a therapist.
In high school.
Wow, yeah.
That's early. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should I go ahead and also go into the story of intro? Actually, I met my husband in Fresno and we moved here. But so my husband's name is Tim, and he is the middle of six children. And like many middle children, he is empathic and a good listener and kind of the go-between or the peacemaker, peacekeeper. And when he was very close to his mother, who was really the anchor of their home. She was very spiritual and really the holder of the family. And when he was in his first year in college, so he's only 21, and as I said, they were very close, and he used to be, he talks of having conversations with her at the kitchen table and, you know, about philosophy and life, and just sounds like a really warm, loving person. I didn't meet her, but it sounded like a beautiful person and a beautiful relationship. But when he was 21, she drove about 40 miles away on a fall afternoon to get groceries for Thanksgiving because they were cheaper there. She drove to an army base to get groceries, but unfortunately fell asleep at the wheel and crashed and went into a ditch. And this was way before cell phones. This was in 78. And she was taken to a hospital and operated on and was in the ICU, but taken out of ICU because they thought she was better. But she complained of not feeling well and really being in a lot of pain. So they brought her back into the ICU, but unfortunately she died. And when she died, the family fell apart because the dad, who was mourning and probably in shock, sort of abandoned the family, actually. And so the family was now rudderless because they had no parent. He even sold the home that they were all living in. So people scattered. The two older siblings moved away. And Tim, who's in the middle, stayed. And his sister, who was only just barely 17, got married and moved to the East Coast. So it was Tim and his two younger brothers and no place to live. So at 21, Tim really hit the ground, adulthood running, and had to get two jobs, and he had to quit college. And the hours he worked were really long. He had one full-time job 5 days a week, and then on the weekends worked all day and all night. And so he was never home, but providing for a new house that he bought and for these two younger siblings who were just in high school. And trying to be like an adult and handling this adult stuff, and being just a barely young, barely into adulthood himself, really, really struggled by working hard and there never being enough. So Tim's money story, and we all have a story, is that you have to work really hard and not have any fun, but there won't be enough.
Okay, so you've jumped right into it. I'm hearing it. Unfortunately, I'm hearing an echo.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Which, do you have a headset or anything like that?
I don't have one.
Nothing like that.
No, shoot. I didn't bring them.
Try turning the speaker down a bit.
Oh, down. Okay, sure.
Yeah. Make sure that you can hear me, but we just don't want to get that echo.
Okay. How's that sound?
I think that's going to work.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've jumped into the money story, which is an important part of the whole thing. I was thinking further back. You jumped into Tim's story.
Oh, that's his.
Totally skipping your own.
Oh,
so
okay.
Let's back up a little bit here and talk about your family of origin and what was going on for you, even as a young girl. Because
sure.
I think in the book you lay a lot of foundation for where you go later.
Sure. Well, I mentioned Tim's because they end up fitting together, which couples often do. And
yes.
So my story is that I was an unexpected twin. that my sister and I were unexpected twins. The pregnancy was planned, but that they would have twins was a surprise.
Fraternal and, or?
We're unidentical.
You're identical?
Unidentical, fraternal twins, yes.
We had twins ourselves. We have fraternal twins. And,
oh, you do?
Yeah, I'm always interested in that. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
So my sister was born, and they didn't know I was there. my mom and the nurse thought that there was another one, and the doctor and the nurse kind of got into it a bit, apparently. And my mom also said, I think there's another one, and finally believed them. The doctor finally believed them, and I was born 9 minutes later. And the reason that's important is because I often was reminded that I was a surprise, or that having twins was a surprise. And my mom told the story about arguing with a doctor while she's laying on the, you know, on the bed, having just delivered my twin. Every birthday, or even if I remember, sometimes we would be in a restaurant, and if somebody had a baby, she would turn and talk to them about their baby, and then point over to me and say, "And this one, I remember when I had babies, and this one was a surprise." And so I was often reminded about not only that I was a surprise, but how expensive it was to have twins, and how she had to run out and get two of everything. And so I believe I took on a wound and a story of an unexpected guest, and that I should be happy with whatever I got and try not to make much noise and provide for myself. So in junior high school,
that was the part I was missing. That was the part I was interested in having to talk about.
And so, like, even in junior high school, I got babysitting jobs, and my sisters didn't work, but I worked when they were in school. But I worked from the time I was pretty young, and I look back on that now and wonder if it was because I didn't want to, be a burden, a financial burden. So how that fits with my husband's story is he was off and working, and his belief was there's never enough. And I felt like my part was not to be upset about there not being enough. I was already used to that.
Yeah.
And so there's that expression, his claws fit her wounds.
Yeah, I had not heard that expression until I encountered it in your book.
His claws
fit her wounds.
Yeah, so in the visual, sort of like this, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and so I just accepted that there wouldn't be enough because that's what I was used to. And I also didn't know enough then to know I could change that story because it was unconscious. And so we went along together, never feeling like there was enough for things like vacations or to fix things in the house when they went, you know, when things broke or needed tending to. There, it always felt like things were tight. And that was sort of the catalyst for the abundance circles was I noticed that in other people, whether it's that their financial situation feels bleak and they can't get out of it, or they can't attract a partner, or whatever their story is, we just keep perpetuating it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you kind of skipped ahead to the abundance circles, which I was hoping to get to more towards the end.
Sure, we can get to it later.
Because, you know, let's get into the whole, I mean, you became a therapist before you started doing the abundance circles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so tell us about that journey. What drew you to it, how you got into it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I probably got into it because of the adults in my life that I admired so much and feeling moved by them and knowing that therapy can provide freedom and healing, freedom from our limiting stories and beliefs and healing from, you know, playing smaller versions of ourselves. So I think I got into it for those reasons, like watching the adults in my life and then got my master's in psychology and love things like family systems and attachment theory and Jung. Those are the ways I practice. I'm pretty eclectic, I think, depending on what shows up in front of me. But those are the ones that really, really move me, as well as mindfulness, which I also kind of have as part of a thread through my therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. So at what point did you become aware of the abundance circles of that approach? Right? I mean, you created your own abundance circle.
Right.
We should back up, I guess, and talk about The Secret. There was a book called and a film called The Secret that came about in 2006, I believe. Rhonda Ryan, how do you say her name?
I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I think, yeah.
Something like that. And so at what point did that cross your path with your issues that you shared with Tim, feeling like you were just scrimping to get by and there was never really enough? Certainly not abundance, right?
So right.
At what point did you, and you were already raising, what, one or more children?
Yeah, two boys.
Two boys, yeah. Mm-hmm. So here you are, you're a therapist, you're what, in midlife or before that?
Mm-hmm. Midlife, mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So what happens?
Let me break in here to tell you a bit about our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. Is there something interfering with your happiness or that's preventing you from achieving your goals? I know years ago through therapy, I learned that I had a tendency to undermine myself by sharing material that could be used against me. Now, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log in to your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. For example, here's a review I found on their site just today. Quotes, "I'm a totally different person now than when I signed up 19 months ago. I found my voice and can speak up for myself now. My confidence level is also better than it's ever been." Close quote. Visit BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 700,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Fortunately, there's a special offer for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. You can get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/shrink. Now, back to the interview.
Well, I really appreciated The Secret when it came out. It was quite a few years later that the Abundance Circle tools came to me. But what I appreciated about The Secret was her kind of bringing all of these principles into one place. As you know, some of these are very old ideas, but I liked her bringing them all in like that. And it really made me be a lot more conscious of my thoughts, and that our thoughts can produce, you know, changes on the outside. I did feel like it missed doing the unconscious work that the abundance circles do include, like shadow material, for example. I'm not finding fault in The Secret, but I think that that's a really, the things like our unconscious belief. I mean, our unconscious beliefs and our unconscious, our shadow material, like I said, are also at play and need to be looked at. It's not just thinking positively, and it's not just reframing things or doing affirmations. What happens, or at least what I found with my clients before I discovered the tools for the Abundance Circle, was sometimes people would feel bad about trying the, you know, being positive or doing affirmations because it wasn't enough and it wasn't working. They felt like, I can't even get that right.
Yeah, yeah. So in a way, sometimes people want to jump ahead to the golden, to get the golden fleece without doing the work.
Right.
In the context of psychotherapy and what we know about psychotherapy, there's inner work that likely needs to be done before mm-hmm. one could experience that abundance that they're being
part right.
in unconscious ways. And so that kind of brings us to your book. And your book, of course, has this title in it of The Seven Tools for an Unstoppable Life. Let me stop you there and say, unstoppable, where does that come from? What's that?
So I believe that, you know, there's only one of each of us and that we have these amazing gifts inside of us and gifts to share with the world that we keep hidden because we're either afraid to show up or we've learned to suppress them or we're not even in touch with them. And as we use these tools that are in the book and learn to show up more fully, that magnificent things happen for us and for the people who are the recipients of our gifts. And so I see that as being unstoppable in the world and living a life kind of on fire and, you know, very lit up and excited yeah. and yeah. able to manifest and attract what we want and show up more fully, bringing more of ourselves to the world, which is exciting for others too, because I think the world's waiting for all of our gifts and we do no good for us or them by keeping them hidden. I think probably the person who made me think of unstoppable was somebody that's actually an example in the book, a woman who really, really wanted to find a partner, but she wasn't even dating, let alone, you know, finding a person to marry. She was in her 30s and just an awesome woman, had her own home, was making good money. She's funny, kind, attractive, lovable, bright. So that she wasn't dating didn't make sense. And she was letting friends know to tell their friends. Uh-huh. So on paper and in her life, it looked like it should be working that she met somebody. She became somebody, she was somebody in one of my circles who, when she looked at her unconscious blocks and shifted it, suddenly had lots of men showing up in the course of the eight sessions that we meet. And I remember thinking that she just seemed like that it was raining men for her and that that she was like, she's unstoppable. There's no stopping her. Yeah. Now she has her choice of men, and she did end up marrying and has a really happy life. So she was probably the person I was thinking of when I said living your unstoppable life. She was just, you know, there was no stopping her.
Okay. Well, you talked about the circles and the tools. So again, and it sounds like the way that you've said it, that this idea for the circles or these tools came to you at a later point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or did The Secret already have in it the idea that people would get together to encourage one another to move in this direction?
Did The Secret also have the concept of a circle? Do you say?
Yeah.
Not that I saw. I think of what I remember about The Secret was that it was sort of individual work.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now you've listed these seven tools that you say kind of came to you. How did they come to you?
They came in a really interesting way. They showed up individually and in the order they are in the book. And when I say showed up, I mean, well, you know how one of the tools is synchronicity. So the tool showed up in a very synchronistic way, actually. I would bump into something for a while, like how important it is to get very clear on what we want to attract and do work on it. And I think, yeah, that's a good concept. And I think I'll work on that. I'll think I'll be focused on how I can create more abundance in our life, for example. That's a good thing to remember, that I need to really stay present to calling that in.
Yeah.
And so then I thought of, you know, we have to have deep desire needs work behind it. And I thought, okay, that's true, but kind of let it go. And then I would bump into the importance of receiving, which is tool number two. And it just kept showing up in my life. By showing up, I mean, I'd get an email in my inbox where somebody had written about the importance of receiving. And then I would be driving to work and the car in front of me would have, as its personalized license plate, the word receiving. I thought, I wonder why I keep hearing about receiving. That's interesting. So they kept showing up like that in order. And then before all of them came, I thought, I got this hit that this is what I'm seeing is the formation of something, and it's an abundance circle, and I'm supposed to create this abundance circle, and then more, which, what I decided to do, and then more tools showed up after that. And then when the seventh one did, I asked kind of out to the universe, are there more? And I heard, nope, that's it. This is grace and gratitude is the last one, and that's seven tools, and we've just completed. And it just sort of, it was almost like a download. It just kept, they just came and they've come in order until I got, oh, this is another tool. And when I had that thought, the next one showed up.
So you didn't start off with the idea of, I want to write a book and I'm trying to think of the chapters.
No, did not show up.
Starting from the place of, I really am taken by this idea of the secret of having more abundance come into my life in an easy fashion. And really wrestling with that question for yourself. What is it that I need to do? What's blocking me, right?
Yeah.
And so the first one that you came up with, which makes a lot of sense to me, is wounds. You list seven. Wounds is the first thing you list. And you have a colon in the book, How the Light Gets In, which made me think of the Leonard Cohen song. The origin of that idea. That's how the light gets in. Were you aware of his song? Was that part of it for you?
Not until I was more aware of Rumi's quote about light getting in through the wound. I was later aware of the Leonard Cohen song. And that's not actually a tool. The first tool is Deep Desire Plus Work. But you're right. The book starts with wounds is how the lights get in. Because I think it's important to try to recognize our wounds and what gifts are trying to emerge from them.
I gather in that is the notion that the wounds are important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not just, I mean, often our focus is on the symptom, the pain that we're in, and that would seem to be just totally extraneous to anything good in our life that we would want. It's in the way.
Right.
But here's this sort of deeper ancient wisdom that says, well, this wound may be have an important message for you. It's part of your destiny. It's part of your toolkit, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that in people, don't we? When they get sick or can't attract a partner or they have an accident. Or money isn't showing up, or you really bump into things, or our stories, like rough backgrounds. So many wise people I know and people whose stories I'm really moved by have really rough backgrounds, for example, and rough childhoods.
Yeah.
And these gifts that came from these rough places are just extraordinary. I think that's where we find out what we're made of, for one thing. Sometimes they also give us pause. Like, for example, when we're sick and in bed, sometimes we get awarenesses because we're not distracted by the busyness of life. I'm really struck by how wounds can be a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. And in your, was that a principle that you were also integrating in the one-to-one therapy that you were doing with people?
Absolutely, yeah.
Mostly a family therapist, right?
Pardon?
Have you mostly been a family therapist?
Not really. I mostly see individuals, actually, but their family of origin stories are important to me.
Yeah.
And their backgrounds, even if they're doing present-day work, which I do also focus on, I like knowing about their stories and their backgrounds and, you know, what informed them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. So anything more to say about wounds and, you know, how that finds its way into your book and into your work?
Yeah, I think the other thing I'd want to say about wounds is that when we have these rough places, if we can get separate from it and take a stance of what is this here to teach me versus why did this happen to me, we can really glean the gift from these rough places.
Yeah. In my experience, there's a dangerous kind of interface there in the sort of New Age movement, if you will. And mm-hmm. the sacred definitely would fall into that category in my mind. Uh-huh. Of the danger of blaming a person. There's a very slight, subtle difference there between taking responsibility. Okay, what's my responsibility in this story?
Right.
Versus having, I think of Job and the story of Job in the Bible and the so-called friends who come around and are kind of, well, you know, well, geez, Job, what did you do to bring this on yourself?
Mm-hmm.
That there's the room for a kind of blame game there. And Job, I think, went into blaming himself quite a bit.
Yeah.
The reason why this is so personal for me is my mother died of cancer, of colon cancer, and she had been raised in a kind of evangelical home, which she rejected and kind of ran away from all of that. And then when she came down with cancer and struggled with that, mm-hmm. She kind of went back to God and tried to repair things with her evangelist mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a period of remission and felt mm-hmm. that she was healed. And, oh, thank God, I've been healed. Then the remission went away, as often happens in the course of cancer. And so she took a turn for the worse. And she really suffered from the sense of guilt mm-hmm. and burden that I let go of my faith.
Oh.
I didn't maintain my faith strong enough.
Yeah.
This is why it's now turned around. And that's something that I observe acutely in that case, but more generally in the at that time among my own friends and all, was a tendency to kind of toss off people's pains and burdens. If they want to be stuck in that old tape, you know, and mm-hmm. it's not going to take responsibility. And mm-hmm. so it's the community could be very non-compassionate.
Yeah. At a time behind people need
this
it
positive
so much.
Idea of, well, we write our own story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And how rough it is when people have to, you know, go through things like that when they yeah. need support more than ever.
Yeah. So how do you avoid that in your work with people and your work with yourself? Because clearly you're not hung up on it the way that I am.
mm-hmm. I think, so how would I, like if I had, for example, your mom who's on the receiving end of that, or working with people to not be dishing that out, or both?
Yeah.
So how would I support your mom, for example, in that? Or how would
sure, that's a good place to go.
Yeah. This, you know, this didn't happen because your mom was somehow failing in her faith. And to have something that's such a would have been such a positive for her, which is her faith, obviously, and have it turned against her by people on the outside is really sad to me. Yeah. And I think I'd probably work with her on knowing that that's not so, that it had nothing to do with a lack of faith or anything on her part, that, you know, that this is something that has happened, and getting through that, as opposed to the focus being on what I did wrong to get here. Let's focus on getting better or feeling as much peace as you can while you're in this and things like that. But that there's no room for blame in there or any place. There's accountability, but there's in life, but there's no room for blame.
Right. And I think I've come to have a fuller understanding of the idea of healing due to the work of many people. The healing isn't necessarily getting over the disease or living longer, but it's got more to do with healing from the torment, from the, the torment of that one has subjected oneself to, maybe feeling like God has abandoned them or whatever, that they're being punished.
Yeah.
And so
I agree.
If one can get past that piece of it and integrate that piece of it, then I think we need to consider that a healing.
I do too. I think that's so well said. I think that's my objective as well, is getting through, the hurt that's in here, not just the illness, but the shaming that we do and things like that are so important, that we get rid of those kind of things, that those are toxic.
Yeah. So I'm going to go to the next tool in your book, which is, you characterize as deep desire plus work in theory. And then the next one after that is plus work in practice.
Right.
So that's an interesting, so tell us about that second step that came to you.
Yeah.
Desire,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Earnest that desire.
Right.
Plus
right.
work in theory. And what do you mean plus work in theory?
So work in theory would be, to use the example of the woman who ended up attracting a lot of men, working in theory would be doing her unconscious work, or the inside work.
Uh-huh.
So deep desire plus work is broken into inner and outer work.
Okay.
So the theory piece is, like I said, the inner work. So in her case, one day when she was talking again in the circle about how what she wanted was to attract a partner to share her life with, because it was really good except for that one missing piece. And that's true for a lot of people. There's just, life is pretty good, except I would really like this thing. So one day she was talking about that again. And I noticed when she said something about wanting to get married, she made a little tiny face or grimace. It's like, I really want to get married. And it was very subtle.
Uh-huh.
So I pointed out that, I hear you saying that, but I noticed that I also kept picking up on a little bit of hesitation. What might that be about? And she said, well, I was married once before, very briefly, didn't have children, but the man I married was very controlling. And I feel like I lost my voice with him. And I said, oh, well, if that's the case, and thank you for sharing that, because that's really important. But if that's the case, I wonder if there's a part of you that, as much as you want to get married, maybe thinks, if that's what it looks like, I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And good. She said, I guess, yes, so. And I said, then you can, seems to me, you can either decide, instead of getting married, I want a long-term committed relationship, but not getting married. Or you can also decide, I still want to get married, but I don't want to attract somebody like that. I'm going to change my vision of what marriage looks like. It will no longer look like my past relationship, but I'll be with a person who I have complete freedom to use my voice with. We're equal partners and I feel really good in it. And that's what she decided, was that that's what she was going to attract. But she had to make that conscious choice for, so that would be her inner work, was she needed to rewrite what marriage looked like for her so she could fully invite it in.
So in theory, she wanted this change, this development to come into her life. But in actuality, there was something blocking it at the unconscious level.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we need to do that work, but there's also a practical side of it, of, for example, and if what we want to do is attract somebody, but we're against being online, online sites for meeting people, or we're afraid to let our friends know we're looking because that's embarrassing or something. We have to get past all that, but we also have to do work like doing things that are uncomfortable and getting on those getting online dating online dating sites and things like that. So you have to put some practical behind your desire. The last six letters of attraction are action. And so you need to put some outward motion toward this deep inner desire.
Right, right. One of the central notions of The Secret was called the law of attraction, that whatever you deeply desire enough, you'll draw it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And but we have to beware the human tendency to be passive around that.
Yes.
Right? So I'm thinking of the old saying, the Lord helps them who helps themselves.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you're talking about here. That,
yes, that absolutely.
It's not enough to, if you're not going to dating sites and you're not letting people know that you're looking for a mate, how's it going to happen?
Yeah.
Just magically.
Yes, absolutely. And the same would be, and that principle that you just mentioned is true no matter what it is we're trying to attract. The same would be true of finances. You know, we can't sit in our living room wishing that, you know, that it will just show up. We can try to send out positive thoughts about that and deeply desire it, but we also have to go to work.
Yeah.
Or find creative ways to pull in more money, things like that.
Right.
You have to do both, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. So that's tool two and tool three then was the deep desire, but then in tool three, bringing it into practice somehow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So actually that's tool one. Deep desire plus work is tool one and two, but it shows up in the book as chapter one and two because it was too long to put them together.
Okay. So then it moves into the finesse of receiving, the finesse of receiving.
Yes.
Finesse is such an interesting word. It's a word that's got a lot of finesse to it.
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
receiving is so important, and we're not very good at it. And I don't mean to stereotype, but we women are actually worse at receiving, which is ironic because the archetype for a woman is a chalice, which gets filled up.
Yeah.
So that's our nature, and it goes way back. It's an ancient archetype. So we actually are fighting against our nature when we're bad at receiving, when we're not good at receiving.
A lot of times you try to give somebody a compliment. One tries to give somebody a compliment, and particularly with the young women, I taught for quite a few years, and. particularly at a certain age, when they're very young, there's a lot of, and a lot of extra sort of speech kind of stuff that's all getting around them taking a stand and really being who they are.
Yeah.
Yes. And an unwillingness to, I would have to challenge them to get to recognize a strength or something good mm-hmm. that they've just done.
That's kind of
what you're saying.
Yeah. I think we've been brought up to think that somebody giving us a compliment might want something, or I need to give it right back, or what does he want, or is it sincere? Or it just gets so brings it up to our head instead of just receiving it graciously, you know, and with grace, and just saying, well, thank you, and receiving it.
Exactly. I think that's a growth stage, and I think that's what you're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
Stage of personal development to move past the place of having to discount and just take it in.
Mm-hmm.
And let it nourish you. That's sort of what I've learned to do over the years is when people give me that stuff, I try to remember it and just bring it in close to my heart instead of discounting it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's a real gift, isn't it?
Yeah, it really
is. Yeah. Whether it's a compliment or help, a lot of times we won't receive help we need.
Yeah.
Thinking that it looks like weakness. But if we can think of receiving as not taking, but as allowing, then that can make it a lot easier. Also, if we can remember how good it feels to us to give to others, that if we reject that, we're not allowing others to feel good.
Yeah, right. They're trying to express something from their core nature. And
Absolutely.
So it can be a gift to just say, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we brush off compliments, don't we?
Yeah. But what about the word finesse there? How did that come to you?
Well, originally I just had the tools just literally listed, like deep desire plus work, receiving shadow. And I thought, no, if people aren't familiar with these tools or these concepts, they need a little bit of, a little bit of an embellishment of the word. Yeah. And I thought, well, what does receiving mean to me? And I thought, well, if there's a finesse to it that we can, which is not rejecting it, but just letting it in. And that's it's a beautiful dance, somebody gives us something to just receive it. And I just sort of tied that with finesse, that there's a beautiful flow.
Yeah. It suggests to me a kind of elegance.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Elegantly. Yeah.
Yes. That's how I see it too.
And so now we get into the tough part, which you speak as shadow material. So tell us about that, the role of that as in moving towards abundance.
Okay. So if somebody listening doesn't know what shadow is, the term was created by Carl Jung, and it has to do with the parts of ourselves that we've hidden underground. It's not in our shadow because it's sinister or dark, but it, to us, we thought there was something wrong with these traits. Yeah. And so we learned to hide them, and they're out of the light of our awareness. And if we don't tend to our shadow material, it tends to incite us into behaviors we don't like, or into maybe even to addictions to hide the parts of ourselves we've deemed inappropriate or unlovable. So that could be anger. We could have anger in our shadow, or softness, or we could have vanity in our shadow. And then what we do is push down anything that we believe is anything close to these traits. But what happens is we spend so much energy pushing it down that we actually attract more of it and come from there. So the way to find out what's in our shadow, since it's unconscious, is to look at what bothers us and other people.
Right.
Yep. What's the thing that really works you about people?
Uh-huh.
And so, for example, if it's when I first looked at it, I was thinking, well, I don't like loud, opinionated, judgmental people. And then, of course, the irony of that hit me, that by having that be what I least like in others, I'm being judgmental.
Yeah. We share that shadow thing, I think. That also bothers me about other people. An exercise that I would do in a class that I taught about a lot of this kind of thing, and developed what I thought was a good shadow exercise, where I would have people imagine a person who just really gets under their skin and really gets their goat. And, what is the essence of that person? If you could boil that person down to a one-liner, what would that one-liner be? And so I think for me it was something like, I don't have enough time for you, I don't have time for the little people. I was thinking of a colleague at the university, another colleague who just irritated me because I felt that he thought that he was just so brilliant that, that he was above us all. So in my exercise, first people had to get in touch with what that was for them, then kind of get into a body stance that expresses that, and then we would walk around and act it out.
Keep
encountering people. So I would wander around the classroom, with my students. Well, I don't have time for you, And, and then we would write about it and reflect on it and so on. So, you've gotten me all ignited again, reminding me about
the way we
project.
Yes. And we think that we're so different from these people. That's why shadow is so incredible. Yeah. It comes back to that thing we learned when we were little, like about if you point a finger, you've got three pointing back at you. Yeah. And And we think we are so different from that. That's why it bothers us, is because I'm not like that.
Right, right.
But if we can turn it around, go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, how did you work that material for yourself and for other people that you've worked with?
Well, I kind of like you did, like first getting people in touch with what their shadow is. For example, there was a woman hers was what she doesn't like, she said, was critical people. And she said, because I'm not that, I'm really having a hard time learning how to flip it into a positive. I'm not at all critical. And then she said, oh, except toward myself. She learned to because she had that clarity, she learned to stop being quite as critical of herself. But the main way I use it in the circles is to find the positive opposite of it.
Yeah, which I think of as something about discernment.
Right.
Maybe one slant on it. Maybe there's a different one.
I like that.
Yeah,
that's good.
The person who's very critical is also the positive side of that is being discerning and going on.
Yes, that's really good. And then you can bring that out more. If it's in our shadow, though, we might not be as discerning as we could be in life. But every single shadow has a positive opposite and needs to be brought out.
Yeah.
For example, if vanity is in our, like if what we don't like are vain people, we might find that we're also somebody that struggles with confidence because we don't want to have anything to do with anything that smacks of vanity. So we really push down.
Yeah, we're leaning over backwards to avoid it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which doesn't serve us well at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything more about shadow?
Well, it makes me think of how Carl Jung came up with it in the first place. He hadn't given it a lot of importance until he had a client that was really rational. And no matter what he said, she brought it up to her, you know, to ego mind and pushed it away. And she talked a lot in her sessions and wasn't available. And he thought, I'm going to need something really big to break open her shell if she ever is going to shift, because she's not getting anything from our therapy at all. And one day she had, and he brought that up a lot too, that, you know, that I find you to be very rational and in your head, and we need to, you know, come down to your emotion and to your heart. But she just was blocked. And then one day she was telling him about a dream in which somebody gave her a costly piece of jewelry, which was a scarab beetle. And it was had a jewel in its center and was really beautiful. And she was talking about this beetle, you know, in her dream and how somebody had given her that. But he was distracted as he was listening to her because behind him was a window and there was a tapping at the window. So he opened up the window to see what it was, and it was a beetle, which he caught with his hand, and he handed it to her and he said, "There's your scarab."
Yeah.
And it also represented her, who had this shell around her. And in that session and in that, you know, that event that happened, it broke her open and she got less out of her head. That synchronicity of that scarab showing up when she was speaking about it broke her open.
Wonderful retelling of the story there. I couldn't quite remember it, but you brought it back to me.
So I just think that knowing our shadow and what's keeping us smaller versions of ourselves and breaking that open and bringing out instead the positive side of what's in our in our shadow is so vital.
Well, let's talk about I am statements, because that's the next chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I am statements are so powerful. They kind of telegraph to the world how we feel about ourselves, don't they? I think that our I ams dictate how we treat ourselves, and then people treat us how we tell them to treat us because of the way we talk to ourselves. I am statements too are often unconscious. But the mind doesn't know the difference or recognize the difference between conscious thought and unconscious thought, or kidding and being serious. So let's say I'm working on the computer and can't figure something out. If I say, I'm so old, I can't figure out this computer, or I'm so dumb because I don't get this thing, the mind registers that. Yeah. And those run under the radar often. So it's a lot more important if we can flip that, and a lot more accurate too, to say, I just don't understand this thing, versus I'm old or I'm stupid.
Yeah. Boy, I caught myself in that very thing recently. And I think that's part of the trick, is to catch yourself, because these thoughts can flip by so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They become part of our, quotes, unconscious.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They're kind of lurking there. And it was almost something like you were talking, I don't remember if it was a computer or what, but I heard myself say to myself something like, you old fogey.
Oh, and wow.
I'm shocked to become aware of that. I try to be mindful about this stuff. And I was like, where did that come from?
You know? Right?
And I tried to rip that in the bud.
Yes.
But,
and you're mindful of it. Like you said, imagine how if we've never thought about IMs being important, how often they run things. And so what's good if we catch them is to flip it immediately. Like, let's say I say, I can't believe I messed up there, I'm so dumb, to immediately flip it to I'm so bright, I'm so smart, I'm so intelligent.
Yeah.
The reason it fits into the abundance circle is because whatever we're trying to attract, I think, would be important to use I am statements around. So if my struggle is financial, I might use I am statements like I am abundant.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
I would imagine the first step is, I don't know, you tell me which comes first. Does putting it out there to other people as a way of convincing oneself work, or is it better to, or do you have to own it first and then start putting it out there? Is there a sequence?
Probably starting with ourselves and really, owning that. But what's neat about I am statements is that when we start thinking it, it starts coming out that way as well. I don't even know if we need to say it to other people for them to get the IAMs that we're embodying. In other words, people feel our energy. So if my self-talk is really poor, I'm going to attract feedback that matches that. People will give us proof of what our IAMs are.
Yes.
Right? But if our IAMs are positive, we tend to get positive reflection back.
At the same time, though, it's not just your self-talk. If your public talk is one where you're playing up your fallibilities and your weaknesses and so on, people will support you in that.
Yeah, they sure will. Yeah. Well,
that's too bad. I know you've struggled with that forever, right?
Yeah. I think, though, I don't know, what do you think? I think that if our self-talk was in alignment with who we want to be, I doubt we would say it, say the opposite in the world.
It's a chicken and egg problem, I think. I mean, they're both true.
Mm-hmm. So to your point, it would be important to both say positive IMs and speak positive IMs to others.
Even if at first it feels artificial.
Yeah.
It can be. I'm not big on universal rules, but it can be that kind of practice then gets internalized at some point. And
absolutely.
Partly because it's being supported by, as you pointed out, people will support the story that you're putting out.
Absolutely.
So it's a two-part thing. I mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think so too.
It'll help build your story if you can put out the story that you want, even though in the beginning it may feel artificial.
I think it can at first, especially if who we want to show up as is sort of in contrast with who we have felt ourselves to be.
It's hard to change.
Words.
It's hard to change.
Yeah.
I had a colleague who's a good tennis player. And I was a very intermediate tennis player, and he came along one day and wanted to show me something about my serve. You know, I was doing my serve all wrong. Well, after he showed me this improved way to do the serve, my serve went all to hell. I mean, what happened was, he was challenging me in a way that I had to pay more attention to what I'd been doing. Mm. And as you bring more attention to it, it's got to reconsolidate. To have the new learning that he was trying to bring my way couldn't happen as long as the old stuff was in the way. That's
another one. Right.
So I had to kind of unlearn the way I had been, the comfortable, and I was comfortable with my serve. So I had to unlearn and lose the comfort. I had to move into the discomfort of having screwed up my serve to then be able to let in the light through the cracks and reconsolidate in a higher level.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Yes. Getting rid of what doesn't serve us anymore.
You know,
literally. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, to make way for the good.
Yeah. Okay, I'm still moving along your chapters here. Love versus fear.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah, it really is. Yes. So, you know, I noticed as I was getting the tools, I noticed this progression of getting more confident and trying to be more healed. And then what follows after that is love versus fear, because ideally, as things start showing up in our life, because we're now able to attract them and have them coming in, it can be scary. It can be scary because it's new and we're used to this old way of being. And if we can take a stand for this is what I've been wanting and come from a very open place, we can keep the flow coming. But if we get afraid of it showing up in the world, in our world, we can block it again.
Yeah.
And it can feel like it was just a fluke that it started to show up. Mm-hmm. So love is if you want to think in terms of frequency, it's a higher frequency than fear. And so we want to come from that place as often as possible and keep the flow coming. And if we're not sure, we can kind of tell which one we're coming from, if it's love or fear, by the way it feels in our body or the words we use. Like, I'm afraid if I do that I won't be successful. I'm afraid if I study this thing in college that it really moves me, I won't get a job. I'm afraid if I leave this abusive relationship, I'll never find somebody else. Mm. So fear can really keep us stuck in places.
Yeah.
I realize that fear has a place in life and we need to pay attention when it shows up. But it also sometimes is false and it's not real. And so it's really important to distinguish between the two.
Yeah.
And in the book, I mentioned that I believe that fear is actually the opposite of love, not hate. And so we always have a choice of coming from love or from fear. Uh-huh. But it's especially important when we're trying to attract the life we want to come from love as often as possible.
Okay. Well, a lot of what we've been talking about has been work that you've been doing for a number of years in what you call gratitude circles, and you've made reference to it a number of times here. So I think before we go away, we need to let people know what gratitude circles are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a structure that you've created. And mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Yeah, they're actually called abundance circles,
is what I meant to say.
Quite all right. Gratitude does play a big part of abundance, I believe. It's the last tool, in fact, gratitude and grace. So I can see why you thought that. But the abundance circles meet every 2 weeks for 8 sessions, and we go through all these tools. And then what I find works well in a group setting versus us doing it on our own is that as people are speaking what it is they want to attract, they've got other people in their circle that help support that that vision too. So you're not only speaking it out loud in this circle, which I think is probably more powerful in a way than just writing it at home in our journal and then shutting the book. because something spoken in the world now feels very real. We're also more accountable for it. Like, somebody heard me say that. I better, I really want to work on this.
Yeah.
Plus, people in the circle sometimes say, I noticed that what you said you wanted to do is X, Y, and Z. Well, I also know somebody that does that. And maybe, like, you just get not only emotional support, but literal support.
Yeah.
Like that. But that's the way that it's been structured up until now, was just these 8 session, every other week sessions. And I'll continue to do these abundance circles.
Uh-huh.
But I'm also going to now be doing online circles, because not everybody lives near me and can come. So I'll be doing the exact same format online, and also doing another option of retreats, where I do them for 2 days in cities all over the U.S. So with the 8 or the 7 tools in a 2-day retreat, so that I can take them further, these tools further, because I've seen them have such a big impact on people's lives.
Yeah,
so
you've gotten a lot of positive feedback for this approach that you've developed, and now it's expanding.
Mm, thank you. Yeah, feels good.
If people want to, quotes, follow you, learn more, et cetera, do you have a website that they should go to? Or, well, obviously, there's your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your book.
You're right, there's my book, Beep, Beep, Get Out of My Way, 7 Tools for Living Your Unstoppable Life.
Uh-huh.
Is available on Amazon and some other local stores here. I'm also on Instagram under Catherine DeMonte, and on Facebook. You can reach out that way as well.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, Catherine, I think maybe we've come to it here. I really want to thank you for sharing all that you shared with me today.
My pleasure, Dr. Dave. Thank you. And thank you for all the good you're doing in the world with this program and with your work. Well, you're reaching so many people.
Well, thank you.
It's a gift. Yeah, okay. You're welcome.
My guest, Catherine DeMonte, LCSW, has such a bubbly, outgoing, optimistic personality that it's little wonder that she is enjoying such success in the Abundant Circles work that she's been pioneering. As our conversation revealed, this work was gradually revealed to her as she was working to implement the message of the 2006 New Age film and follow-on book, The Secret, into her own life. The film and subsequent book by Australian radio TV producer Rhonda Byrne became an instant bestseller, especially after being strongly endorsed by Oprah Winfrey. The book became a worldwide bestseller, translated into 50 languages, with more than 20 million copies in print. According to Byrne's website, The Secret book has remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 190 weeks and was named by USA Today as one of the top 20 best-selling books of the past 15 years. Byrne appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show in 2007 with 4 teachers from The Secret film. Later that same year, Rhonda Byrne was recognized as one of the world's most influential people in Time magazine's The Time 100, The People Who Shape Our World, and shortly afterwards appeared in the Forbes Celebrity 100 list. I remember seeing the film when it first came out. It had all the high production values of a major Hollywood motion picture, and it referenced the paradoxical findings coming out of quantum physics to suggest a world of infinite possibilities in alignment with the mystical teachings of the ages. The Secret champions the notion of, quotes, the law of attraction, close quote, that a benevolent universe will provide not only for your needs, but for whatever wishes you invest with sufficient emotional energy and faith. Fear keeps us trapped in a belief system of scarcity. Love teaches us that everything is connected and that we live in an abundant universe that is eager to support us. This message was certainly congruent with streams of thought swimming around in the culture at large, as well as the human potential movement, humanistic and transpersonal psychology, and the underground psychedelic movement. For me, the message was inviting and inspiring on the one hand, but also seemed suspect on other grounds, striking me as simplistic, old wine in new bottles, ignoring or denying that there are realities beyond our personal power to influence, and so on. So, once again, I find myself in a kind of middle ground where I can find some value in the secret in terms of inspiration and motivation and a reminder to not get locked into too rigid a conception of reality and, at the same time, keep my feet on the ground. I do have to grant that there are many people out there who say their material lives have been transformed by embracing the secret and its law of attraction. There are whole books and workshops and trainings based on those transformations. My guest, Catherine DeMonte, is one of those. As she explains, she and her husband both were leading lives of chronic economic struggle and came to realize that they were being held back by unconscious beliefs that they did not deserve more. By rooting out those unconscious blocks and changing their thinking, their lives became more abundant financially. So, despite my own reservations about the secret, I think with her psychotherapeutic training, Catherine DeMonte's innovative abundant circles enhances the process for others to create more financial abundance in their own lives by providing them with peer group support and encouragement, along with psychologically sophisticated self-examination.
Oh, Dr. Dave, this is Dr. Marilyn Steele calling, and I want to thank you so much for your program and just give you a few words on why I have become a subscriber. I had such a marvelous interview with you several years ago, and you are just unique in your depth of questions and the quality of your presence and listening. And I knew I was able to say things that don't normally occur to me that I was so glad I was able to say. So thank you for that and for the wonderful array of speakers and authors and teachers that you have on. I so enjoy many of them, especially on shamanism and the divine feminine and dreaming and the imaginal realms. I'm always inspired in terms of my creativity and just nourishment for my soul. So thank you for all the work that you do and the gifts that you are bringing to us all the time. Thank you, Dr. Dave. All right. All the best. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Marilyn Steele. I do appreciate your longtime support and recognition. And thanks to all our ongoing financial donors, you know who you are. Also, thanks go out to recent donors, including Oscar Stahl, Diane Kronmiller, Catherine Lee, John Kozlowski, and Sandy Lai, who has also stepped forward to do some transcription, and finally, Dr. Jennifer Dorr, MD, who was my recent guest on episode number 673. We're now solidly into the new year, and I wish the news were better. Australia is suffering unparalleled losses due to the wildfires there, which seem to underscore that climate change is upon us even sooner and with more devastating consequences than expected. And as if that's not enough, the situation between the U.S. and Iran has us all holding our breath. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks again to licensed marriage family therapist Catherine DeMonte for sharing her personal journey and her book, Beep Beep, Get Out of My Way, 7 Tools for Living Your Unstoppable Life. My next guest, John Robinson, PhD, has appeared on the show several times before. In this next episode, we'll be discussing his newest book, Mystical Activism, Transforming a World in Crisis. World crisis indeed. Dr. Robinson's book could not be more timely. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.